Station number 2655,
Reel 9. Right. Mr. Kinnear, Reel 9. Now, what about that? Can we ask about, once you've been refitted, the messing system and the food you got, especially when you were at sea? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, we went back to general messing.
Could you explain that? What was general messing? How did it work?
Yeah, well, how it worked was you sent the cooks of the mess to the galley, they collected the grub, and they brought it down and they dished it out on the individual mess decks. And of course, it depended on weather conditions, what you got, because if the weather was too rough, it was impossible to keep things on the galley stoves. So you had to make do with bully beef sandwiches and things like that. Something that was easy that the cooks could achieve in the galley under those terrible conditions.
Now, did you get enough? I mean, when it was, the weather was okay, but, you know, did you get enough food at sea? I mean,
no, I was always hungry, and so were the majority of the lads. The only time I had enough to eat was when a lot of the boys were seasick and didn't want theirs, so we could get a double helping kind of thing. But in harbour, it was okay.
Now, what sort of food did you get? Can you remember now?
It was pretty standard. We got soups. Our favourite was pea do, as we called it. It was pea soup, thick pea soup, and that was the best soup that was ever invented in the Navy. And that was a part of the meal, and it was good stuff. It was good, thick stuff. Other was thin stuff. You know, then you had a variety. It was a good variety of food, but unfortunately there was never enough of it at sea for big going lads. And you were always hungry because the cold and the sea air always made you hungry.
Now, where we've got to is you're with the 5th Escort Group and you're on a lot of Atlantic convoys, or on Atlantic convoys. Now, what's the next thing you remember? What, you know, we go through the sort of things that happened to you in the ship now, as you remember them.
Yeah, well, periodically we would be sent out with an escort carrier, and in particular the Vindex, on an anti-submarine sweep.
Now, tell me what they were like.
Well, you worked in cooperation with the carrier. The carrier sent the planes off on scouting missions, and if the plane spotted one, it would summon us to it, you see. Now, in one particular case, that was early in 44, I think it was, we were with the Vindex, and our captain was the half leader. So the group was split into two divisions. Our captain was a second division leader. And we were detailed off. An aeroplane had sighted a U-boat because it had dived, and before he got to it, and he summoned us. And the Captain D, which was McIntyre, on the what was he on then? The Bickerton. He raced there with the first division, and us three, the three remaining under our captain, were detailed off to safeguard the carrier, keep it out of harm's way, you see. But you're in contact all the time with the leader, with the group leader, and of course they found the sub and they sank it. You know, they picked up the contact, because they used to get all sorts of bearings off the huffed off if the U-boats had the habit, you see, of coming to the surface and making reports, and they were pretty detailed reports, and we could pick these up on the Huff Duff, that's a high frequency direction finders, and follow that bearing, and that brought them to the U-boat, you see. And of course then it was plastered. Anyway, they sank that one and they got a few survivors off it. That was the first U-boat that we sank as a group.
You don't know which one it was?
Well, it was a combination of the three.
No, sorry, which U-boat it was, the number, they never found out which it was after the war, or you don't know?
Yeah, well, we've got it in, I've got it all that.
It's in the record. So
it's in the record, yeah.
That was the first success for the group?
That was the first success for the group. That was very early in 44, you know, one of the first sweeps we did. And things were varied. A few occasions, we were taking big transport ships loaded with army personnel up the Mediterranean, you know, through the bay, up the Mediterranean to Italy. And, of course, we were detailed off to escort them through.
What do you remember those trips?
Oh, it was very nice up the Med. We didn't mind going up the Med. It was always nice and warm there. Once you got through the bay, you were pretty safe because we were driving the Germans back at that time in Italy. And we took them. We took a load of troops up, a load of transports up to Naples. And that was our job done. Other occasion, we'd go up to Malta. And but we never ever got ashore at Malta. Because invariably, if we were up in that area, once we sighted Malta and did an about turn then, because they were all disposed of, the ships were disposed of to Malta, and they were met by local escorts, one thing or another, and we were detailed to go somewhere else.
Those were easier trips from the sound of the Mediterranean.
Oh, yeah. Well, mind you, at one time we were coming down through the Med. It was winter, and it was rough in the Med, and it can get very rough in the Med. And we knew damn well that once we passed Gib, we got through the Straits of Gibraltar and got into the bay, that we were really in for it, because it was a damn sight worse there. So that was that. We had a couple of stops at Gibraltar, you know, a couple of runs ashore there.
What was that like?
It was very good. It was always good to be in port, you know. We're only there for a couple of days because we're in great demand. Now, in 1944, Christmas 1944, we pulled into Gib.
Now, hang on. We've jumped about 8 months there. And so I'm not, you know, there may be, I know what you mean. It's routine and we've done a lot of the routine. But
yeah.
Were you on anything connected with D-Day in June 44?
Oh, in June 44. Well, we were. But what happened to us was we were doing all these exercises, scapa flow and the channel, and one thing or other, sweeps of the channel. And during one of these sweeps, we had a contact, and we'd let go all sorts of charges. And unfortunately, there was always a floor and a couple of floors on these ships we were on, and one of the welding on the brackets holding the A-frame, which was supporting the shaft to the screw, to one of the screws, that broke. And of course we had to limp in the day. We had to leave the channel on the 5th. I'm almost certain it was the 5th of June 44, and we were detailed to go in for repairs to Glasgow, and we were heading into Glasgow when. Into Govan Dry Dock when June the 6th invasion started. Now, of course, our skipper went mad, he missed it. But we weren't there long, it was just a welding job, and I suppose we were a couple of days in Govan and then back to rejoin the group. But it was fortunate for us in one respect, but it was tragic for the ship that relieved us, the Morn. Because she was hit by, we think it was two acoustic torpedoes or something of that order, and she just disintegrated. She went down in about 2 minutes, and even less, terrible loss of life. That was that one.
Yeah, so anything after D-Day, then you were on these various things you've described, you know, and then you got to Christmas, you're saying. Christmas.
Oh, well, before then,
okay.
We went to, with a big fleet, mainly carriers. We were detailed off to escort an escort carrier called the Nabob. It was a big fleet because we were expecting the Tirpitz to come out. You see, and the idea was for the carriers, and we had seven big fleet carriers and a couple of what we called the Woolworth carriers, the escort carriers, and they were sending planes off to attack it. where it was in, I think it was in Alton Fjord in Norway. And we steamed up the coast of Norway in broad daylight, and we could see the coast quite clearly, but only a few miles out, and because we were expecting air attacks at any minute, and we were at defence stations, I think they called it, which was four on, four off. All the ready-use lockers were all open, as much ready-use ammunition on there around the guns. But in the event, we didn't get any air attack. But they didn't have the Foxes out, which was a big rattler which we towed astern, which confused the what did they call those?
Acoustic torpedoes.
The acoustic torpedoes.
And how did it work? Tell us about the Fox. It was on, what?
Well, the Foxer was just a rattler. As you towed it astern of you, it caused all this rattling, and it confused the acoustic torpedo, and the acoustic torpedo would head for the Foxer. But unfortunately, this time, we didn't have them out. And in the morning of, I think it was around about the 22nd, 24th of August, 22nd of August, 44, it was Operation Goodwood, and the planes had gone off and were steaming away with this fleet. And in the morning of that day, our Captain D on the Bickerton ordered us to change places with him. We'd been shielding or screening the Nabob, which was an aircraft carrier, and he was screening the heavy cruiser Kent on the other wing, and he ordered us to change places with him, which we did. And in late afternoon, I think it was around about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I was asleep at the time, because I'd come off watch, I can't remember what it was. A pal of mine woke me up, and he says, "Quick, Scouse," he said, "quick, let's get up." And then all the alarms went going, and he said, "The Nabob's just been torpedoed." And then bang, he said, "Oh, God, there's another one gone." So, because by that time the alarms were all gone, we flew up on deck. And there was the Nabob. She was down by the stern, and the other one which had got it was the Bickerton, which had relieved us in that position in the morning. So we all start steaming away, and then we peeled off, and our skipper came over to the loudspeaker, and he says, "We've been ordered to return to the scene, you know, and find the U-boat and sink it." Right, so we go steaming past. And I can still see all these, the crew of the Nabob on the deck, and she's down by the stern. The Bickerton was down by the stern. And all the crew of the Nabob were cheering like hell at us, because they had bright yellow scarves on, you know, for distinguishing marks in the water. And they were heading towards where we thought the U-boat was. And the next thing, we about 10, and the skipper come on again. He said, "I've just been received fresh instructions to stop and pick up survivors." So that's what we did. And for the next few hours, we were between the Nabob and the Bickerton picking survivors up.
Now, how did they actually do that? I mean, did you heave to? That's a bit risky with the submarine.
It was, yeah. Well, it was risky, all right. Originally, we were instructed to take all the wounded off the Nabob. So we go, and we're going to go alongside the Nabob, but you know we had these sponsons and gun platforms were jutted out from them. Well, it was a pretty heavy swell, and we got lifted up under the this sponson of the Nabob. And of course we got jammed there, and our starboard anchor was snapped off, and that dropped down onto the Nabob's deck. So I don't know what happened to that afterwards. So we had to get away, back off there, and stand off. And they were sending their wounded over in boats. And the same with the
Bickerton.
The Bickerton. Now, this crowd had come over, come alongside, and a couple of us jumped over the side into the boat, because we only had a low freeboard. And we jumped over the side, myself and a pal of mine, and we're helping the wounded up, because we didn't have enough stretchers, and we were only a little ship. And we got down to the last two, and I said, "Oh, these poor fellas are dead. They were lying in the bottom, just covered over." no movement out. And I said, well, I'm not leaving them here. So I said, we got planks, we got anything down that we could. And I said, okay, you take the head. Or I took the head and he took the feet. And then the screams that come out were horrendous. These lads were burnt to hell. And they called us for everything. Their language was short. You couldn't help it. So because we thought we lived in dead bodies. And I come down, I said, well, we can't leave me here. And the ship's stopping, we've got to do something, you know. I said, right, do as quick as we can. One, two, three, heave. And we did it like that, and we got them up onto the ship. You know, because our ship was stopped. And it had been backwards and forwards, stopped in a couple of knots, you know, here and there, so pick up different ones. And so that's what happened. So we had survivors off the wounded off the Nabob, but there's a lot of able-bodied fellows come off them as well. Most of them was Canadians, you know, mostly. And then we had our own survivors off the Bickerton, which was ready to go any time, as we thought. But in the event, the Bickerton didn't sink and neither did the Nabob. And they said, well, they got the Nabob's engines going again, and she was down by the stern, and she was able to make a few knots. The Bickerton couldn't, because she'd received this, what did they call it, was it a gnat? Something, there was a name for this torpedo, apart from being an acoustic torpedo. And that had hit in the stern in the engine room, and because there was, I think there was about 40 odd men killed on that ship. So anyway, eventually a fleet destroyer came back and torpedoed her and put her down, you know, to make sure, because they were sturdy little ships, they took at some hell of a knocks, you know. So that was more or less that. So we were overloaded then with survivors. All our bags and hammocks were used to get them up anyway. And when we went alongside the carrier, they were using the hammocks, not the bags, the hammocks, as fenders to protect our own ship, you know. So consequently, all that was taken up, and the wounded was, of course, in our bunks and one thing and another. So at the time, I was quartermaster as well, and there was about 11 of us lived in the wheelhouse until we got back to Scapa Flow with all the wounded. But this U-boat was still in the area, and he made another couple of, or he tried to make a couple of attacks, so we blasted him. And of course, our main thing was to safeguard this carrier again, you see. So it was after a couple of hours that the Admiral in charge, I think it was Fraser was there, Admiral Fraser, he was in overall charge, but there was the big battle fleet was in two divisions, and Rear Admiral McGregor was in charge of the second division, in which we were part. And they sent two more ships back to help us and to safeguard the carrier. But in the night time, it attacked, the alarms went, and of course we plastered the damn things, you know, and we don't know what happened. But eventually that U-boat was sunk, I think, was the next day by somebody got the credit for it out of the crowd, you know, but it wasn't us anyway.
Now, can you tell us a bit, so you got back safely?
So we got back to Scapa Flow, and when we got to Scapa Flow, they sent all these shot boats out and MFVs to take the wounded off. And then when the ship was all cleared, and of course, as you can imagine, there was blood and God knows what everywhere. It was clear lower deck, and the ship had to be scrubbed from stem to stern and sterilised, you know, disinfected. And we thought that was a bit much because we'd had no sleep, nothing, you know, next to no sleep for days on end. Anyway, so that was the story of that. And we got the Nabob in, and the last I saw of her, she was in... I don't think it was Scapa, but I think they got her into Rosyth.
Now, one thing to mention was you said you were quartermaster by then, and you mentioned this earlier, but can you tell us what the quartermaster's duties were?
Oh, yeah, well, your duty was on the wheel, mainly, and also you control the telegraphs.
Now what does that mean? You mentioned we talked about the wheel, but
the speed of the ship, the telegraphs, and they were situated in the wheelhouse. And the skipper would sing out, what was it, standard, full and flank. It was American telegraphs, you see. So you had standard, usually. And then you had the revolution regulator, you know, a telegraph, if you like. And they'd sing out to us 500 revolutions. Well, that was a pretty fast speed, so we put 500 revolutions on. You know, then depending upon what revolutions had been determined, and they might say up 10 revolutions, down 10, up 20, up 30, down 20, 30, as the case may be, just to correspond with whatever that was required on the bridge, especially to keep station.
And you'd actually do that?
Oh, we'd do you'd that. Oh, we did all that.
How did you change it? Was it just a...
Oh, there was a dial there, you know, and you just turn the dial and 500 and up it come, you know.
Now, we talked about the wheel, because when you were assistant bosun, you said you'd yeah. take a turn on it, possibly, you know. Anything else you had to do as quartermaster?
No, that was just about it. The bosun's mate, of course, was the general flunky there. The quartermaster was in charge, but he didn't leave the wheelhouse. But the bosun's mate would be detailed off to leave the wheelhouse, especially when it was his turn to go and call the watch, you know, at night time. He'd go down and in the mess decks, and of course the mess decks were never entirely in darkness. They always had this, I think it was a red light down below, or was it blue? I can't remember the colour now, but I think it was blue, but that gave just sufficient light for you to see where you were going down below.
And what about when you were in port? Do you have any particular duties in port as quartermaster?
Oh yeah, well, you were in charge of the gangway then, and you did the duties on the gangway. And of course,
now what were the duties on the gangway?
Well, you had to maintain a log, the daily log. We also had a duty of regulating all the ship's clocks. We had a chronometer for that, and no matter what had happened, even in the skipper's cabin, because I've actually knelt on the skipper's sea bunk and said, yeah, excuse me, sir, he's asleep, like you've been up all night. Excuse me, sir, I have to do the clock. Yeah, carry on. And you knelt on it to reach over him to check the clock. Yeah, you did that. And, of course, there was the jetty sentry. And you were more or less in charge of the jetty sentry as well, you know. And if there was anything passing, of course, you'd have to pipe the ship that was passing, and together with the bosun's mate, and you'd lower the ensign in salute, you see, and put it back up. The same thing in the morning. You'd have to raise the colours. And in the evening, of course, you had to reverse it. You know, you'd load the colours.
Was it a good job, quartermaster? I mean, was it seen as a plum post, or...?
Not really. It wasn't a bad post. But it had its onerous duties kind of thing. You know, you had to make sure, and you had to report everything. You were more or less the watchman when you were in port. Together with the bosun's mate, you were the watchman. And, of course, you had to ensure that the ship was safe. And, of course, you checked whoever came aboard.
Now, were you an able seaman when you were made quartermaster?
Yeah.
Was there a sort of special exam before you were made able seaman, or was it just a time thing?
Yeah, well, I think I covered this earlier when I got this Mr. Man, when I referred to Mr. Man, the
you
first
mentioned
lieutenant.
When we were talking about Man, yes. That's
yeah, and...
was there anything else other than that?
I applied for AB because he got extra cash as well, you see. And I applied for... to be promoted to AB, and of course he took me round the ship, and he was asking me questions, he was testing me on my knowledge.
He did, sir. Was that it, though? There was nothing else?
No.
That was it? Right.
But he took me right round the ship, and it was absolutely thorough, I can assure you. This was for an hour or so, you know.
And did it make a big difference, being able to see me, or was it just more money?
No, it was just more cash. It was just one of the lads, just the same, you know. It wasn't much more cash either.
So what's the next thing? That was August 1944, the NABOB, the Operation Goodwood. What's any other incidents that happened now? Late summer, early October, you know, autumn.
So that was later. That's when they, I think we came back from there. And I think that's when, that's right, that's when we went up the Med with the troop transport.
So you mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah. And I did tell you, but so we were on our way back and we're going to call into Jib, which we did, and we thought, goody, this is about the 22nd of December, 23rd of December. We said, well, we're going to be in port for Christmas. But, however, a U-boat was sighted, or supposedly sighted, in the Bay of Biscay, and we were chased after it. So we were out all over the Christmas. And eventually, we didn't get anything. Because the Bay of Biscay was notoriously rough as well. The weather was bad. Anyway, we didn't find the U-boat. I can't even remember whether we made any depth charge attacks, whether we had any alarms or not. No. And then we were back in and we celebrated our New Year, our Christmas and New Year, I think, in Gibraltar. And the next day we're on our way again. And where did we go then? Back into the North Atlantic, I think it was.
And what were you doing there? Convoy or
after that, convoy and anti-submarine sweeps. That's to the best of my recollection, you know. That was late 44, beginning 45, wasn't it? Of course, I think we just carried on, and I think we did another couple of convoys up, not convoys, troop transports up the Med.
Now, you'd get leave occasionally, wouldn't you? We haven't talked about leave. What would a typical leave be like?
Well, the leave we got was from Pollock Dockyard, and it was usually 7 days. It was the non-duty watch. We were given 7 days, but it was more or less a day's travel getting home and a day's travel coming back, so you only had about 5 days.
Was it a bad journey?
It was, really, because we used to have to... We get a train... Oh, first and foremost, what I've got to tell you, that the customs, and because we had our duty-free cigarettes, and we knew nobody at home had cigarettes to... You know, they did have some, but it was terribly rationed. And so we'd always take some home for the family. But no, if them customs at Belfast caught you, that was it. No option, 14-day sales.
Yeah. Were you ever caught?
No.
Did you take anything back?
I certainly did. Could have liked out of them. Oh, we had all sorts of ruses, but...
What sort of thing?
Well, we used to make... We'd make a bundle up. That's the way I did. I'd make a bundle up, a parcel, and I'd stick that down behind me, under the seat, if he could get it under the seat, on the coach or whatever. But you had to be brazen with it. And the officer of the day, I can always remember, the officer of the day went down specially to the gate, and he said, boys, you'll have to watch yourself. The customs are out in force with the police. The police were always with them, you see. But the police were all right. They'd come aboard at night for their share of ciggies, you know, and no problem. But the customs, there was just no leeway at all with them. It didn't matter what you'd done, where you'd been. You were going on leave. You had an extra packet of cigarettes. Oh, smuggling, that's what they called it, smuggling. It was so stupid. And we never had a lot of money. We weren't going to make a lot of money either. Because... In general, you were taking cigarettes home for your parents.